I'm Marco Werman. Before we get to the show, we have some news. When you make a gift to PRI's The World Now, your contribution will be matched dollar for dollar. Visit theworld.org/match to make your gift. And thanks for your support. What? Me worry? Today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, firing his attorney general and stepping up his attacks on the press. If you're worried that President Trump's actions are starting to feel authoritarian, you're not alone.
Well, he's certainly not behaving in accordance with the norms and procedures of democracy. And yesterday's actions were simply the latest in a long line of actions that make people like myself, who study democracies and dictatorships, quite concerned.
Plus, a backlash for Japanese women who challenge sexual harassment.
To say Me Too is quite dangerous in Japan. So we came up to say We Too, so no one can target me or individual.
Those stories and much more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Thanks for joining us. When it comes to the Trump presidency, there's so much to talk about today. Let's start with the big question. What's next for Robert Mueller? He's still in charge of the investigation into Russian interference in the 2016 election, but his new boss is a Donald Trump loyalist. Matthew Whitaker has expressed strong skepticism about the special counsel. So does that mean that Mueller's time is up? Not yet, says Harvard University law professor Lawrence Tribe. He says Whitaker's very appointment is unconstitutional.
This guy has never been confirmed by the Senate and almost certainly wouldn't be. But whether he would be or not, he is simply a staffer. He is clearly somebody who requires Senate confirmation. And so the appointment is illegal.
Even as an interim appointment?
Even as an interim appointment. This is not, after all, an appointment for a couple of days to fill an emergency. He's being appointed for the duration, in all likelihood, of the Mueller probe. It's not simply an appointment of a technical nature to handle certain details in the absence of the Attorney General. The Attorney General was fired. The president created the gap that he is now filling in violation of the Constitution. And he's doing it in order to protect himself from meaningful investigation. Investigation into something much more profound than just the Watergate break-in. It's investigation of whether he colluded and conspired with a hostile foreign power to win the presidency. Nothing could be more obviously unacceptable under the Constitution. Even someone like Judge Kavanaugh, who for all of the things that might be said critical of him as a good lawyer, be hard for me to imagine if the case gets to the Supreme Court that even Justice Kavanaugh or Justice Gorsuch or Justice Thomas would uphold this. Thomas himself wrote an opinion just last year saying that a principal officer of the United States can't exercise those basic powers when he's answerable only to the president without Senate confirmation. So you've got Justice Thomas saying that the installation of someone like Matt Whitaker is unconstitutional. I think he would be followed by the Chief Justice and others on the current court. So this is a kind of Hail Mary pass into a dead zone rather than the end zone.
Trump was asked point blank at yesterday's press conference if he would end the Mueller investigation and remove special counsel Robert Mueller from his position. This is what he said.
I could have ended it any time I wanted. I didn't. And there was no collusion. There was no anything. I didn't.
And then the president added this.
It should end because it's very bad for our country.
So Donald Trump has authority over the Department of Justice. The investigation, Trump and his supporters say it's gone on too long and there's nothing to show for it. Don't they have a point?
No, they don't have a point. There's plenty to show for it. If you count up the number of indictments, the number of guilty pleas, the number of convictions, they've got an unbelievable amount to show for it. It's not up to the president himself to be judge in his own case and to say repeatedly, no collusion, no corruption, no obstruction. That's his opinion. And of course, who would expect him to say anything different? Any halfway competent court would say that this was an illegal move by the president, and it is part of a pattern of obstruction of justice, the details of which will certainly come to light.
Yeah, a lot of people would see the firing of Mueller as a major constitutional crisis. I'm wondering, I know you've got strong feelings about that. Surely Robert Mueller, though, has contingency plans in place. Do you know what they might be?
Well, I certainly don't have any inside track. Mueller has been appropriately closed-mouthed about everything he's doing. But we can see that he's obviously handed off a number of cases to other U.S. attorneys' offices and to other parts of the Justice Department. All that he's discovered is not simply going to evaporate in some magical shredder that the president would like to conjure in his head. It's history. It's there, and it's going to be revealed. It's only a question of exactly how.
Harvard University Law Professor Lawrence Tribe, good to have you with us today. Thank you.
Good to be with you.
If there were an idiot's guide to authoritarian rule, two of the first steps might include the following. One, fire the nation's top law enforcement official. Check. And two, pick a fight with the press by revoking the credentials of a reporter who asks too many questions. Check again. And that's led to a lot of people wondering, is President Trump behaving like an authoritarian? I put that to Sherry Berman, professor of political science at Barnard.
Well, he's certainly not behaving in accordance with the norms and procedures of democracy. And yesterday's actions, firing Jeff Sessions, revoking the press credentials of a CNN reporter, were simply the latest in a long line of actions that make people like myself, who study democracies and dictatorships, quite concerned.
Is it fair to compare Trump to autocrats like Vladimir Putin in Russia or Recep Tayyip Erdogan in Turkey?
So that's a great question, but it's not an easy one to answer. I mean, certainly Donald Trump does not seem to sort of have either a good understanding of or much respect for the norms and procedures of democracy. He obviously prefers to be not restrained. He does not seem to like the idea of checks and balances. He does not seem to understand the way rule of law works. However, our democracies, our democratic institutions are much stronger than those in places like Turkey or Russia.
So lots of people are tempted to compare Trump to Putin and Erdogan. I mean, if you just line up the person, how does Trump compare to like those two leaders?
So there are clearly some qualities that they all share. They're quite uninterested in being constrained. They value loyalty. They don't like checks and balances. And they believe that once elected, they should have pretty much untrammeled power. And so in that sense, there are some very striking similarities among those three leaders, as well as through autocratically inclined politicians elsewhere. Again, the major question is, does the American democratic system have enough strengths to check someone like that in a way that the systems in Russia and Turkey did not?
What examples from history would you cite as kind of parallels to the current presidency?
In American history?
In any history.
Well, in American history, there are certainly times when we have been quite polarized before. And I think those are probably familiar to everyone who's taken an American history class. Not that long ago, we could think about the 1960s, the McCarthy era, and of course, the Civil War. But those are indicative cases, right? Especially the latter, because we tore ourselves apart in the bloodiest conflict in our history. But the more general question about polarization does provide insights, I think, into the conditions under which democracies decay. I mean, democracies fall apart when people have lost faith in them, when they're willing to embrace radical extremists to offer an alternative vision about the way the political system should be organized. And that obviously is antithetical to democracy. So the more those ideas or attitudes spread, the less likely it is to keep those rules of the game in place. That is to say, to have a healthy, well-functioning democratic system.
Let me get back to Trump's feisty and often offensive relationship with the press. We saw a very good example yesterday with the revoking of Jim Acosta, CNN's White House press credentials. The news site Axios in September wrote this, and I quote, "Cable news is setting records, books are hot again, newspapers are racking up the digital subscriptions, and an op-ed is a hot gossip topic, all because of the national obsession with the Trump show. Trump and the media, for all his attacks and despite the cultural chasm between them, just can't quit each other," end quote. I mean, CNN and many others are making bank on Trump. How do you square that with Trump in this very authoritarian way, calling the media the enemy of the people? Isn't the press in a devil's bargain of sorts?
It is certainly true that the more interested people are in politics, the better it is in some sense for the media. But a free media, a free press is absolutely essential to democracy. And so regardless of what kind of lock they are in with each other, it is really not appropriate. It is not acceptable. It is not healthy for a democracy for the president to be attacking the media, members of the press, simply for being critical to him.
Sherry Berman, professor of political science at Barnard College in New York. Thank you.
Thank you.
Joyce Karam is also struck by Trump's treatment of the media. Karam is from Lebanon and a longtime Washington correspondent. She writes for The National, a newspaper based in Abu Dhabi in the Persian Gulf.
The same language that's used by President Trump, fake news, enemy of the people, is being repeated now in the region by apologists to authoritarian regimes. And I mean, is this the standard now that when the U.S. president attacks the New York Times or CNN as fake news, that Egypt or other governments or Turkey will follow through and use the same words? That's very dangerous.
Well, here's Jim Acosta of CNN trying to ask some hard questions of President Trump yesterday, which resulted in his White House press credentials being revoked.
That you may have.
I'm not concerned about anything with the Russian investigation because it's a hoax. Are you, that's enough. Put down the mic.
Mr. President, are you worried about indictments coming down in this investigation? Mr. President.
I'll tell you what, CNN should be ashamed of itself having you working for them. You are a rude, terrible person. You shouldn't be working for CNN. Go ahead.
Joyce Karam, you've had your press credentials revoked yourself. That wasn't in Washington, though.
Well, Marco, in 2007, I was in Washington, D.C., and I broke a story about Syrian officials from the Assad government visiting D.C., and they met with the pro-Israel lobby in Washington. My editors led with the news as a front page headline. I was at that same in that same month planning a trip to Syria, to Damascus. Right after that story, my editor called and said, I am being advised not to go. And I asked him if this was relayed to him by the Syrian regime. And he said, yes. And I was forced to cancel that trip. So these kind of things, these kind of punitive measures, I'm used to seeing in the Middle East.
Yeah.
But it's again, just surreal to see this language. This personal attacks from the White House. So it's the questions that Jim was raising. I mean, they're just questions. Why not just answer the questions? This hostile environment, it's just shocking.
As a foreign correspondent based in Washington, how have you been characterizing in your language, relating back for the National, your paper, all that is going on in U.S. politics?
Well, you know, the midterms were a big story for us, the election of two Muslim candidates to immigrants. That's, I think, that was thematically that message coming from the midterms was a big story for us because it stands against all what we've just discussed, that, you know, the hostility to immigrants, to the media, to refugees is being countered on a large scale in the ballot box. And so that's how we try. But some stories, you know, to be honest, is sometimes I just look twice at my notes and am I covering the Middle East or am I covering, you know, the United States? Mm. Like the Washington Post story on militias heading to the borders, American militias to counter the caravan. This is just, you know, shell shocking. Is militias going to the U.S. border,
the military, even today, Trump sending the military down to the border.
No, it was actually militias. It was people armed that were going, not the U.S. military. So, again, this is not what I foresaw. Perhaps kind of headlines covering the United States, but this is where we are.
Joyce Karam, Washington correspondent for the Abu Dhabi-based newspaper, The National. Good to have you with us. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Just ahead, the Me Too movement grows in Japan, slowly. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. It's The World. People talk about Me Too as an American movement that's spread around the world, but it's also evolved and adapted in different countries. In Japan, Me Too has been slower to take hold, even though stories of sexual assault and harassment have made headlines there. Here's Ibi Caputo with a story from Tokyo about Japan's own spin on Me Too, or as some there call it, we two.
Hannah says she's never heard of another woman going through what she did.
I've never heard from anyone about what I had.
Hannah is not her real name. She's 29, and she started working as a secretary at a small company last spring. Soon after, her boss began insisting that she tell him who she socializes with outside of work. Her boss is in his 50s and has a wife and two daughters who live far away. Hannah says at first, she felt it was her job to take care of him. He'd regularly ask her to go out with him, to have a drink.
He always say, when did you have sex? He asked me about that thing, so... But, you know, I couldn't say, stop asking me about that, because he's my boss.
Hannah says because he hired her, she had to endure his questions. But then his behavior got even worse. When they went out to lunch with clients, her boss would become jealous and yell at her.
Like in front of everybody.
She slips into Japanese here.
She
says he would complain that I was flirting with everyone. The yelling was so irrational that the whole restaurant would become still. That happened often. Hannah told her friends about what happened to her, but she didn't share it on social media. Women who have told their stories publicly in Japan have been shamed. The face of Me Too in Japan is a journalist named Shiori Ito, who says she was raped by an older journalist, the biographer of Prime Minister Shinzo Abe. She came forward publicly in May 2017. Here she is in an interview with France 24.
I think no one wants to share such a private and horrific experience of rape, and I didn't want to, but what I wanted to do is to change what I experienced afterwards in Japan. There is so little help that we have in Japan, socially and legally, and that is the main reason why I spoke out.
But prosecutors dropped her case, citing lack of evidence. And speaking out made her a target. Ito started getting death threats. She later moved to the UK to escape the backlash. But since that time, a top bureaucrat in Japan's Ministry of Finance resigned after an audio recording was released of him making sexually explicit comments to another female reporter. The reporter who released the recording said she felt empowered by Shiori Ito, but she still wanted to remain anonymous.
I have to say Me Too movement, to say Me Too is quite dangerous in Japan. So we came up to say We Too, so no one can target me or individual.
But even with this Japanese spin, change may be hard to come by. In part because sexual harassment is not a criminal offense in Japan, says Kiori Sato.
It is a big issue. But it's not dealt with as a big issue. It's dealt with as a very small issue, even though most victims' lives are torn up by it, like mine was.
Sato founded a labor union that supports women who have been sexually harassed or assaulted at work. She says for 2.5 years, her boss harassed her. She got to a point where she considered killing herself.
The company that I used to work for didn't do anything for me. And there wasn't a system in Japan that would help me or cover my salary or the medical expenses.
So Sato sued the Japanese government and was awarded workers' compensation, which set a precedent in Japan. After that, she started hearing from other women and realized she wasn't alone. She says that even when women come forward publicly, the people in leadership positions are mostly men, and they often won't listen or take them seriously. But still, women have to keep trying.
As long as we don't give up, we can change the rules and laws in Japan.
But not everyone is on board for the fight. Hannah, the secretary who was harassed by her boss, thinks it's natural that men are in charge. She says Japan is a country where men are more powerful than women, a country where domineering husbands exist, a culture that says women should stay home, that may be gradually changing and working couples are becoming the norm. But she says men can't have babies and women menstruate, which makes them more emotional. And she says because men think more calmly and objectively, they should call the shots. She says, I am all right with men having power over women. Hannah says her own boss did terrible things to her, but she has no intention of suing him because he has a family. The company didn't have a human resources department, but Hannah did complain to the chairman of the board. At first, he didn't believe her, but then she showed him the inappropriate text messages her boss had sent her. After that, her boss apologized, but his aggressive behavior continued. So after 2 months, she quit. Last week, Hannah started a new job. She says she'll be responsible for protecting other employees against bullying and sexual harassment. For The World, I'm Ibi Caputo.
Now, I don't want to make this next story all about me, but gosh, it's a little tough not to take this one personally.
Hello, you are watching English news program.
That voice is from China's state news agency, Xinhua. On the screen, there's a guy in a suit and tie looking into the camera reading the news. In one newscast, he's even making hand gestures. But get this, he's not human. He's a virtual anchor.
Hello, everyone. I'm an English artificial intelligence anchor. This is my very first day in Xinhua News Agency. My voice and appearance are modeled on Zhang Zhao, a real anchor with Xinhua.
There's also a Chinese-speaking version of the AI news anchor. Xinhua says these virtual anchors can work 24 hours a day, reducing news production costs. Yeah, but what about the... whatever. In the videos, these guys are actually pretty impressive looking. Their lips appear to move almost naturally as they talk. I don't want to be too judgmental when it comes to my comrades in the news business, but if you watch the AI news anchor for a couple of minutes or more, it starts to become obvious that they really aren't real.
The development of the media industry calls for continuous innovation and deep integration with the international advanced technologies. I will work tirelessly to keep you informed as texts will be typed into my system, uninterrupted. I look forward to bringing you the brand new news experiences.
Oh, so much I want to say. Anyway, I gotta hand it to my future competition. Ambitious and humble, too.
As an AI news anchor under development, I know there is a lot for me to improve. Thank you for being with us. Bye for now.
Yeah, bye for now, buddy. I've got my eyes on you. Before we get back to the show, we have some exciting news. PRI's The World is participating in Newsmatch, a campaign to raise money for high-quality, independent journalism. When you make a gift to The World now, your gift will be matched dollar for dollar. Listener donations help fund our staff of reporters and producers, international reporting assignments, and the equipment here in our studio that makes this show happen every day. Visit theworld.org/match to make your gift. And thanks very much for your support. I'm Marco Werman. Meet Anna Eskamani, the first Iranian-American to win elected office in Florida.
I never thought I would run for office before, let alone win with such an incredible support of our community. And in the process, we made history.
The daughter of immigrants from Iran enters Florida politics. Her story, just ahead on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. Women across the country made history this week in the midterm elections. Women of color were definitely part of that story. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez in New York, Rashida Tlaib in Michigan, and Ilhan Omar in Minnesota, just to name a few. The World's Shirin Jafari is going to tell us about another group of women who also made history on Tuesday, but probably got a little less attention.
Yeah, we're talking about four Iranian-American women who won their races for local legislative seats in different states.
Okay, who are these Iranian-American women, Shirin?
Okay, so there is Anna Kaplan, who won a seat in New York State Senate, and she was born to a Jewish family in Iran. Her parents decided to send her to the U.S. in 1979. That's when the Islamic Revolution happened in Iran. Then there's Zahra Karimshak. She ran a campaign for Georgia's state senate, and she won. She was born to an Iranian father and American mother. She also served in the U.S. military. Mm. And you also have Sam Hamadani. She's the first Iranian-American judge to be elected in North Carolina.
That's pretty impressive. That leaves us with one more, though.
Yeah, and that's Anna Eskamani. She won a seat in Florida's State House. And this morning, I got a chance to speak with her. Congratulations on your win. How are you feeling today? What's the past 2 days been like for you?
It's been pretty surreal. I never thought I would run for office before, let alone win with such an incredible support of our community. And in the process, we made history as the first Iranian-American elected to any public office in Florida. So we've received hundreds of messages of love and support from across our community here in Central Florida, but also from across the world. So it's been a lot to take in.
Mm-hmm. What's the key issue you ran on?
So we focused on four main issues. You know, I'm a working class daughter of immigrants from Iran. And so my passion's always driven by the struggles of families like mine. So when we knocked on doors and told our story, we focused on the importance of public education, protecting our environment, and building a system where everyone can access health care and you're not denied coverage because of a pre-existing condition. We also talked about gun violence, as District 47 is home to Pulse Nightclub. So focusing on the issues of equality alongside common sense gun safety measures were also some of our issues.
Going back to your background, you in your campaign, you talk a lot about your background as an Iranian American. Why did you think that was important?
Well, it's a part of who I am, and I've always been so proud of my identity as an Iranian American, and part of that is also grounded in my parents.
Both of my parents are from Iran, but they met working at an Orlando donut shop. Always working.
They met working at the same donut shop. And our dad was very shy to tell people he was Iranian because of the stigma associated with it. Our mom, in contrast, was very passionate about her cultural identity, and she recognized our dad's accent and asked him where he was from, and the rest is history. You know, with so little resources, my parents just worked all the time. My dad was a waiter while he studied at the University of Central Florida to become an electrical engineer. And then our mom had a degree from Iran she could not use. So she worked at fast food restaurants and other minimum wage jobs, eventually at Kmart, where she was a department manager.
Have you heard from other Iranian Americans, especially young women, who have seen you reach your goal?
It's been pretty incredible, Shireen, the type of love and support and inspiration that we've ignited among Iranian Americans across the country, and especially Iranian American women and girls. And we've received messages like that across the country of us giving inspiration to Iranian Americans who thought because of their identity they could not run for office, and now they're rethinking that. And that's just remarkable to me, because everyone is valued, everyone is deserving, and everyone deserves to feel valued. And through my win, if we can be a facilitator for that, then I've already done so much, and I really haven't even started yet.
Again, that was Anna Escamani, newly elected to Florida's State House. By the way, Anna also told me that she's been getting messages from a lot of people, not just people here in the States, but also people inside Iran, and they're extremely excited about her success.
Yeah, I can totally imagine that. Now, before you go, Shireen, we're about to hear from a man named Angel Sanchez, someone you told us about recently, because he was central to a story you reported on voting rights for former felons, an issue that was on the ballot this week in Florida.
Yeah, some states in the U.S. have very stringent laws when it comes to voter rights for former prisoners. Until this week, Florida was one of them. It basically banned convicted felons from voting even after they had completed their sentences. It came down to a clemency board to restore that right, and that often took years to complete. About 1.4 million people were affected by these laws. That changed on Tuesday when voters approved giving most convicted felons who have served their time the right to vote.
And just remind us, are laws like the one that was repealed in Florida, how common are they in other democracies?
Well, they're not. Places like Canada, Israel, and South Africa, they allow prisoners who are still in prison to vote. That's not even a question when they are released and they've served their time.
Right. The world's Shireen Jafari, and now that man who campaigned hard to get the ballot measure passed in Florida, Angel Sanchez. I spoke with him earlier today.
How are you, Marco?
I'm very well, thank you. How do you feel today?
Oh, man, it's surreal. To be honest, every chance I have to reflect, I tear up. But at the same time, I'm just thinking of the work that still needs to be done. I don't know if it's something that comes from people who've been impacted by the criminal justice system. They're scared to enjoy the moment because it can be snatched away.
Tell me why this issue was so important to you.
Oh, wow. I mean, for me, it was just the irony of it. I lost my right to vote before I ever had the right to vote. I was in and out of jail as a kid, growing up in bad neighborhoods, and I was tried as an adult at the age of 14 and was convicted at the age of 15. And ironically enough, was not old enough to vote, but was old enough to lose my right to vote for the rest of my life. But to be fair, I at 15, I couldn't care less about my right to vote. I came from a world where survival was first and then being accepted was second. Voting was never in the top three or top 10. But then I went to prison, and in prison, as I started educating myself and wanting to get an education, a practical education, and come out to society and do something with it, I started learning that many of the licenses and practices required you to have this thing they call civil rights restored. So that means that I must have lost something they call civil rights. And what is that? And that's when I learned that I've lost my right to vote for life. I'm like, wait, so I could get out, pay taxes, do everything right, and yet never be able to vote?
But some people believe very strongly that for felons, punishment comes in several forms. And one of them, at least in Florida, is that you lose your right to vote for the rest of your life. I mean, you campaigned for this law. What has been your argument that the right to vote should be restored for former felons?
Well, the first one that resonated with Floridians from all walks of life was that the courts and the prosecutors are the ones that are best suited to know what is the right punishment for the crime. And they determine a sentence. They determine the length of that sentence. And our campaign was that serious crimes may very well deserve serious time. But once that time is done, to add anything onto that would be unfair, unjust. And my other response to that was, while this may seem like it's normal, we just need to look around the country and realize we're an outlier when we say that someone should be punished for the rest of their lives, not with an incarceration, not with probation or parole for the potential of rehabilitation, but with their voting eligibility.
So a successful campaign for you in Florida, Angel, for ex-felons anyway. What is next?
Well, right now we're so focused in Florida. We have, like I said, 1.4 million individuals that have been restored. Our elections, our governor's race, our senator's race, all our elections were decided by less than 100,000 votes. If we can get 10% of that 1.4 million registered and turning out, we could become the new swing voters in Florida.
Ironically, you were not able to vote for this referendum. Do you know what the next election is that you're going to be able to vote in?
It'll be the 2020 election. I'm just excited to be the first in my family, not only to graduate college, but also to be the first in my family to vote come 2020.
And it'll be the first time, as you told us earlier, that you will have voted in your life. I'm guessing that's going to be a pretty exciting time for you.
Very. In fact, in the U.S., we have to wait till you're 18 to vote. I'm 36, so I had to just wait twice as long.
Angel Sanchez, congratulations again, and thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Still in Florida, and a heads up here to my fellow dog people. On Tuesday, nearly 70% of Florida voters supported a ban on greyhound racing. It'll go into effect by 2020. Florida is home to 11 of the country's remaining 17 dog tracks. So this is a big deal for animal rights activists who want greyhound racing banned, not just in Florida, but around the globe. Not to mention a big deal for the greyhounds who can't express their joy on the radio. Christine Dorchak joins me in the studio. She's president of Grey 2K USA Worldwide. It's the group that sponsored Amendment 13, the Florida ban on dog racing, which just won. Let's start locally. How important is it that Florida has now banned dog racing?
Well, Florida is the hub of dog racing worldwide. Greyhound racing as a commercial enterprise was first legalized in Florida in 1931, and the trend was set. Before you knew it, multiple states had also authorized commercial dog racing, and then seven other countries as well. So we are really the birthplace of commercial dog racing. It's an American invention and an American problem.
The victory in Florida was big. 69% of voters supported the ban. What does that tell you?
That tells me that the time has come, and dog racing is now going to end worldwide.
Yeah, so let's move globally here, because I know dog racing is still legal in a handful of countries around the globe, including the UK, Ireland, Vietnam, Mexico, Australia. Do you see a ripple effect happening here?
Absolutely. When voters here in Massachusetts approved Question 3 in 2008...
And you were part of that campaign too,
I was the author of the ballot campaign, and Gray 2KUSA brought that question as well. The effect was that lawmakers in our sister states looked at our legislation with fresh eyes and said, oh, those Massachusetts voters were right. Within months of the passage of Question 3 in Massachusetts, all of the surrounding New England states prohibited dog racing. We then began working in Colorado, Arizona, all across the country. Dog tracks began to close, and the trend is definitely with the greyhounds. Our most recent track closure just before Amendment 13 went to the voters was that we closed the only dog track in China. That dog track in Macau is called the Canadrome. And we worked with lawmakers there. We reached out to the chief executive, who is basically the president of Macau, with an international coalition. We brought the facts forward. We showed that this was not a good thing for the reputation of Macau. And he agreed. And he ordered the track to close. The last race was held on July 21st.
Have you had any other successes around the globe?
Absolutely. For instance, all the dog tracks in London are now closed.
But dog racing is still legal in the UK. But London, you succeeded in closing that.
That is correct. And other tracks around the United Kingdom have also closed. But there's a lot more work to do.
When was dog racing at its peak globally? Like, in how many countries was it legal at its peak, and how fast has opposition grown to it?
Well, after dog racing was legalized in Florida, the Australians really took a great interest in it, and there are dozens and dozens and dozens of tracks in Australia even to this day. United Kingdom and Ireland followed. Vietnam is more recent. Mexico was somewhere in the middle. New Zealand followed Australia. So there were all told 7 countries with dog racing, and now we're down to 6.
And what's up with the popularity in Australia?
Australians like to gamble. You go to any restaurant or bar, you can bet on dog races as you're eating. It's everywhere.
What country do you see as next in terms of a dog racing ban?
I think that the United Kingdom may follow us. Just a week ago, there was a very important meeting in Parliament, and the Working Group on Animals took a lot of testimony about the disappearance of tens of thousands of greyhounds over the years. And this is an industry that's going to finally be held accountable.
What will happen to the greyhounds that are going to get retired?
We are so thrilled. In Florida, this is the moment we've been waiting for. There is a safety net for these dogs in place. Hundreds of greyhound adoption groups have been waiting because we've come close a couple of times to passing a prohibition in the legislature. Close but no cigar. So they've been waiting and organizing. And the beautiful thing about greyhound adoption groups is even as we've ended dog racing in their home states, they've stayed around to help absorb dogs from the states where dog racing is still legal and operational. So there are a number of Wisconsin groups. There hasn't been dog racing in years in Wisconsin, Idaho, all these different states where there once was dog racing. The rescue groups are still there, and they're going to help absorb all the Florida dogs. There are about 3,700 dogs at issue in Florida. We'll have 26 months to bring them into homes, and we're really looking forward to it.
Yeah, beautiful conclusion to that story. Christine Dorshak, president of Gray 2KUSA Worldwide, the group that sponsored Amendment 13, the Florida ban on dog racing, which just won. Christine, thanks for coming in.
Thanks, Marco.
I just know some of you have rescue greyhounds at home and love taking pictures of them. So go ahead, email us your best greyhound pics to myworld@theworld.org. Oil-rich Venezuela is not so rich these days. The country is facing economic collapse and possibly one of the world's worst humanitarian crises, according to the UN. Extreme poverty is on the rise, so is a number of deaths related to child malnutrition. Many people inside and outside of Venezuela blame the policies of socialist President Nicolas Maduro. Maduro blames the opposition and the impact of U.S. sanctions on the economy. Young children are getting hit hard by all of this, as the BBC's Vladimir Hernandez found out on the streets of Caracas.
On a busy street of Caracas, I meet Mariana. She's 11 years old and has been out since early morning, in the heat, asking anyone she can for food. Today we've been very hungry. My body didn't feel right, she tells me. Her mother, Maricela, is alongside her.
I'm asking around for help. Sometimes I have to rummage through rubbish to feed my children. Things have changed for me in the last 3 years. I used to have a job, but now I have to do this. I won't let my children go hungry.
In most towns, it's common to see children rummaging through rubbish to find something to eat. organizations which try to help them say numbers are on the rise. In Caracas, I met up with a group of these children who allowed me to follow their lives for a few days. Edward is 15.
When you are on the streets, lots of things happen to you. The police beat you up, people look down on you. I wouldn't want to be like that all my life. I left home because my mother was abusing me, and I thought it's better that my brothers had the food.
Experts say that abuse is the final straw that drives these children onto the streets. A lot of the violence at home is down to the strains of always being short of food. Fernando Pereira is the head of a charity called SECODAP, which campaigns for children's rights.
We are seeing many cases where parents are abusing children because of hunger. They beat them or burn them because they grab food that was reserved for later or food for someone else in the family. Food has become a cause for conflict at home.
It's nighttime here now. I was told by NGOs that it's common for the groups of children to have a female leader with them. And when I meet Edward and his friends again, they introduce me to Carla, who's 18. She was kicked out of her home in one of the slums after she became pregnant and brought another mouth to feed. There were already 10 people in the house.
We weren't eating much already, and now we hardly had anything, so I came to the streets. But sleeping rough is not easy, as you're always on your toes, because you don't know who's coming for you.
The group now consists of 8 children, mostly male, and Carla. They're all dirty in rags, but can still joke with each other. I go with them to the garden of a small building where they hoped to spend the night. But someone has thrown away the cardboard boxes they were hoping would keep them warm. A chilly night awaits, and a very uncertain future.
The BBC's Vladimir Hernandez reporting there from Caracas, Venezuela. It's a cheap segue, but this time it definitely works. And now, time for something completely different. Schmaltz, that's Yiddish for rendered chicken fat or grease, by the way. It's also been used to describe something that's corny or overly sentimental. Something like this.
Where do I begin to tell the story of how great a love can be?
I bet you never thought you'd hear Andy Williams on the world. The song Where Do I Begin made it into the top 10 in the U.S. and many parts of the globe when it came out in 1970. Hit number one on the easy listening charts here. Not sure if that's a good thing. The tune originally appeared as the theme in the film Love Story, speaking of schmaltz. The reason we're playing it is to remember its composer, Frenchman Francis Lai. He died yesterday at the age of 86. His legacy is this kind of music for cinema. He scored over 100 films in his lifetime. Francis Lai's theme to Love Story was catnip for crooners and instrumentalists the world over. Spanish singer Rafael really took it over the top.
She came into my life and made the living find. She fills my heart.
British clarinet legend Acker Bilk made the melody slinky. For Francis Lai, as a movie composer, it all began 4 years earlier, in 1966, with this.
Qu'est-ce que c'est que l'escalope de saumon frais à la maréchale?
C'est un poisson frais qui est importé de Finlande.
The romantic saga Un homme et une femme, a man and a woman. The French filmmaker Claude Lelouch got Francis Lai to score it. The film was huge, and its theme was a massive hit. Claude Lelouch and Francis Lai would work together on nearly 40 other projects over the years. But the theme to A Man and a Woman, it became synonymous with love, France, the 60s. It was groovy, baby. You'll know it the second you hear it. You've got that combination of the accordion and the female and male vocals going da-ba-da-ba-da. It also went to the top 10 in the U.S. Schmaltzy, yes, but in a good way. So out, it's in. Much respect to the late Francis Lai. Yesterday, the former president of the Cannes Film Festival said about Francis Lai, his melodies had a crazy charm. No disagreement here. We come to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. Ciao, baby.
PRI, Public Radio International.